high today 73. Still foggy, headlights on for safety, 64 degrees Kenosha, 62 in Racine. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next. Support for the morning show comes from Carthage College, home of the Aspire program and its multifaceted approach to career preparation. The new program is designed to cultivate leadership and entrepreneurial skills while empowering each Carthage student to shape a custom career development plan from the first days that they're on campus. Learn more about the Aspire program at carthage.edu/aspire. And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We're tackling a really important issue today, and I'm glad that we have plenty of time to explore it in great detail. The issue or the story today before us is of the importance of those who have been incarcerated and are released, finding their way into meaningful employment and finding a pathway into a life of meaning and purpose out in the community. And how can we make that more possible, a goal that is more within reach? There are all kinds of people who are actually working tirelessly on this really important issue. And we have three of them with us today. First of all, I'm really pleased to welcome back to the program Jim Schatzman, who, of course, has joined us a number of times, sometimes for the Choral Arts Society, but today wearing his hat as Executive Director of Racine Vocational Ministry, Racine Kenosha Vocational Ministry, I think, yes. And we will be reminding you about the important work that this group does on this very issue. For the first time, I'm welcoming into our studios today Patricia Hansen, who is Racine District Attorney. And for, I think, both professional and also personal reasons, this is also an issue that is very important to Patricia Hansen. And so she is here to lend her voice and her support to this cause. And finally, someone who in many respects is our most important guest today, with all due respect to both Jim and Patricia, but Carl McNeil can speak to this concern and issue from a very personal point of view as someone who has been incarcerated, but for the past 20 years has lived a crime-free life. We won't say a sin-free life. That would be probably saying that's not true of any of us, but he has left his life of crime decidedly behind him, and not only has gone on to meaningful employment, but has also become a tireless advocate on behalf of others who find themselves now in the position that he was in 20 years ago. when he got out of prison and needed to find a way to rebuild his life. And he worked for a number of years at CNH, one of the major industries here in town. He is now, among many other things, pastor at Starlight Outreach Ministries in Racine, and doing all kinds of great things in the community. So I'm so glad that all three of you are here. Jim Schatzman, Patricia Hansen, Carl McNeil, we welcome all of you to the morning show.
Thank you so much. Greg. Thank you so much.
Great to have you here. Jim Schatzman, I wonder, one of the reasons we are talking today specifically is about an event that is coming up the day after tomorrow. And before we kind of dig into this big story, let's make sure that we have our listeners understand this event coming up on Thursday, and specifically what it's for and who it's for.
It's an interesting concept, and it's something that has been championed by the local U.S. attorney out of Milwaukee and has brought in other law enforcement, faith members, and members of our community to build an employer expo. And so this is not a job fair. This is an opportunity for employers to meet companies and nonprofits who are working with people who are returning from prison, helping them to get their lives back in order, from pre-apprenticeship programs where they're learning the trades to soft skill organizations that are helping people to kind of get their understanding of life back together, to a child support and other organizations that are really working to help people get the pieces in their life back together. And the employers are meeting the people who are helping people to get their lives together. What we're trying to do is create a pipeline from these organizations to the employer, because we already know where this population is. And employers, quite frankly, right now are struggling to get enough people to the door. For the first time in my professional life in this work, there are more jobs than people. And employers are beginning to panic a little bit that they're just not getting enough quality people to their door, even in spite of the fact that over the last couple years, 20 years or more, it's been possible to kind of write off certain parts of the population because they're not desirable. And I say that with air quotes. Mm-hmm. And so now employers are looking for new pools of employees, but they're nervous, and rightfully so. And so we're introducing organizations who are helping those people to come back to a place where they're job ready, enthusiastic about starting employment, and looking for opportunities.
Right. So this event on Thursday, the Southeastern Wisconsin Reentry Employer Expo, is in a sense an opportunity for a potential employer to meet somebody like you, mm-hmm. representing Racine Kenosha Vocational Ministries, and people from groups roughly similar to it.
Yes, and there are surprisingly, there are close to 20 organizations in our area who are working directly with this population. And this is a chance to introduce them to employers and say, look, if you're looking for another line of potential employees, we're the folks who have access to those people. You need to know us.
Yes. Right. Before we get to Carl McNeil's story, I want to bring in Patricia Hansen again, Racine DA. We really appreciate you being here today.
Oh, of course.
Ahead of you speaking directly to this issue, I would love to hear just a little bit briefly about your own background, the life journey that's taken you to the position that you hold now in Racine.
Oh, sure. I'm a Racine kid, so I've always been there. Grew up in Racine, have always lived in Racine, was educated through Racine Unified. Went away to college thinking, I got to get out of this town, and realized, boy, I really liked it. So I came back to make my home here. I went to Indiana University, and I think the problem for me was not there because I loved the school, but there was no lake. I was like, where's the water? So I made the decision to pursue law school in Wisconsin, because I knew I wanted to come back here and make this my home. And my very first job, I was sworn in on Monday, and I started work on Tuesday at the district attorney's office, and that was in 1995. So I think part of it is that I'm a huge fan of Racine. I'm a proponent of Racine. And sure, we have problems like other cities, but I don't feel like just being a prosecutor means you just have to work on the problems. most of what we do is reactionary. I have to react to what's happened. But opportunities like this allow me to be proactive for us to find ways for people not to come my way in the first place. And so if I can use the office and whatever influence that brings with it to promote this kind of change, then I'm all about that. And frankly, as I've told Jim before, this is entirely selfish for me to even be here, because when people get out of prison and maybe Carl can even speak to this better, sometimes your whole way of life has to change. Sometimes you can't go back to your friends. Sometimes you can't even go back to your family, because that's what bred you to the place that got you in prison in the first place. So for me, if someone gets out of prison and finds a job and finds a calling and or just some stability, the chances are much more likely that they aren't going to come back to me with repeat crimes, recidivism. So this, for me, is just a way to improve my community, and I'm all in, because Racine is an important place to me. I have a lot at stake here. It's where I grew up. It's where my family's from. It's where my family continues to live. And all I want to do is try to make Racine a better place.
I'm just curious. So you began in the DA's office, you said, back in 1995. Mm-hmm. How would you compare 1995 to 2019 when it comes? I mean, I mean specifically in relation to this issue that we're talking about today.
Yeah.
I mean, for instance, 20 years or however many years ago that is, 24 years ago, I guess. I mean, were there 20 organizations, something like Racine Vocational Ministry, out there helping with this very specific issue?
Well, RVM's been around forever.
2002.
Yeah.
So you weren't
close.
Around in 1995.
But not in 95.
Yeah.
And I will tell you that the attitudes have changed dramatically. When I began as a prosecutor, nobody talked about what happened to people when they got out of prison. You know, that was the Department of Corrections problem, and we just moved on to the next case. So I think that has been a monumental shift in the system. And that's not just my office in Racine. That's across the board. So many things have changed in 25 years that you know, even the way we prosecute crimes and how we approach certain crimes. You know, we went through all of the drug war, and now we've come out on the other side, and it's different. And Racine had terrible gang problems in the 90s. And I won't say that's gone, but it's different. And it's got a different face to it, and it's a different problem. So things have changed over time. When I started in 95, crack cocaine was how kids made a living. And now, you know, we've moved on to other kinds of drugs, and it's not necessarily affecting people as young as 14 and 15, which is good, but the problems are just different. So I think by changing our focus a little bit, hopefully we're, you know, helping people to see a different opportunity for themselves.
Very good. For those of you just joining us on today's morning show, we are talking about the crucially important issue of helping people who have been incarcerated, when they get out of prison, find their way back into meaningful employment and become meaningful contributors to their community. And one hopes not return to that life of crime that landed them in prison before. And our third guest today, Carl McNeil, has lived this experience in a lot of direct ways, and we appreciate his willingness to be here on the morning show to talk about his own life's experience and the tremendous success that he has been able to enjoy since getting out of prison back in 1999. And so we're, in a sense, celebrating his 20th anniversary today of this new life that he is enjoying. Carl McNeil, again, we really appreciate you being here. We probably don't have time to probe into every single detail, some of which are probably relatively unpleasant to remember for you, but we need to at least know the kind of the basic framework of the first part of your life and what ultimately led you to be, at least for a few years, behind prison bars. What can you tell us about that? What's important for us to know?
So as the DA, Ms. Patricia Hansen, stated before, in the 90s, crack cocaine was everywhere. And I grew up in a rural area of Chicago, which are the Robert Taylor homes. Mm-hmm. And we had 16 floors in each building and 10 apartments on each floor. And I must say, probably about 97% of the people who represented those communities really were infected and affected by the crack epidemic.
Wow.
And so...
So when you say it was everywhere, you mean it really
it was everywhere.
Much literally.
And so when I look at, you know, certain movies and certain things that are portrayed to our communities today, I actually lived in those communities. And I saw how some of my friends may have gotten hooked on crack as early as teenage age. I saw what it did to certain families. I saw what it did to certain family members in my family. I saw what it did to the entire community. I grew up where gun violence and territory to utilize the pushing up those drugs were very, 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 very high. You know, as young as 8 or 9 years old, I watched and experience drive-bys and things of that nature. And so you kind of get engulfed into the neighborhood that you grew up in. And that was being championed back then, that lifestyle. And so...
Like it was a good thing or
an exciting
thing.
And, yes. Yeah. And so growing up without a father in the home really allowed me to be raised by the community that I resided in. And I ended up doing what I saw the most in my community.
Hmm. When is it that you were ultimately arrested and charged and convicted and put into prison?
So actually, 1999 is the last time I got locked up. And so I got out in 2001. And so I this is a true story here. And so in 97, I got a charge and I got out on probation, and or in 98, and in 99, this is true now. I told the Lord in 98 when I was in jail, I said, listen, if you get me out of this, I won't come back. And I believe a lot of us have made that promise to God. And so I got out, and I ended up doing the same thing I did before. And by 1999, I was back in. And I did about 30 months, so I got it in 2001. And since then, I knew not to lie to the Lord anymore. If I make a commitment to him, I'm going to keep it. You
right.
know, whether I have to, even if I mess up doing the commitment, I'm going to get back to the commitment.
Right.
You know.
So what do you think was different about that commitment you made in 1999 versus the one from a couple of years earlier? Is it that time you meant it, or that time you understood what you were doing when you made that commitment? Or can you help us understand why that commitment you made in 1999 did the trick?
Most of all, I, you know, being raised without a father, and I just was had became a father, and I didn't want to allow my child to be raised the same way I was raised without a father. I had made a commitment to myself early on in life that I wanted to be a father to my child. And so that was one of the reasons I made a change. The other reason is that, you know, if God can take me from the place I was in before and I make a commitment to him, and he says to me, okay, you're not listening, and I have the power to put you back in the same place that you was before. And that was exactly what happened. And I'm like, well, I don't think I want to be in that position anymore. And so those are some of the things that compelled me to make the decision that I wanted to change my life for the good.
Yeah. I'm curious, when you were incarcerated, what kind of conversations would go on between you and your fellow inmates in terms of life after prison? And I'm just curious if there's a really dramatic difference between some who, in a sense, are eager to return to the life that they were living versus others who don't want that life anymore. I mean, are there really drastically different stories, in a sense, being told behind prison bars when you're thinking about the next chapter?
So that's a very interesting question. I can tell you've been doing this a while. You really know how to ask questions. So in the life of prison, you kind of come in engulfed into the life you were previously living. And so it's really, really, really a matter of saying to yourself, you know what? I don't want to be in this lifestyle anymore. And people are not actually campaigning for you to live a different lifestyle. You have to actually make up your mind yourself to say, hey, this is not for me. And I believe that you attract what you market. And so I had to really, really say to not only the guys who I used to run with or who I became friends with while I was incarcerated, I had to say to them, listen, I don't want to live this lifestyle anymore, and I'm done. And it's actually happened to me. Wisconsin used to ship inmates to Tennessee. And so in Tennessee, I said to those who I used to run with while locked up, I said to them, I'm done with this lifestyle. And I was challenged. And I said, well, you guys going to have to, you know, you're going to have to do what you're going to have to do, but I don't want to live this way anymore. And I'm not a little bitty guy, and so
people were willing to listen to you.
Yes, you know, it wasn't that I was scary. It was I was firm. Yeah. I was willing to take whatever came to me not to go down that path again.
Right. The other thing I wonder about is, again, is someone who, is formidable looking, and I'm sure in a lot of ways, although I'm getting a lot of sweetness from you, but I can tell, you know, how tough you can be too or whatever. But anyway, does it take, do you have to, in a sense, humble yourself, make yourself vulnerable to admit that I have really screwed up and I don't want to be the person that I wanted to be? I mean, it seems like it's in some ways a little tricky if one projects this image of I'm strong and you know, nothing can harm me or whatever. You have to, in a sense, let go of that in order to say, I need to be somebody different than I've been.
So growing up in the lifestyle that I previously lived, everybody is grown to be tough. Mm. Humbling yourself is not championed.
Right.
And so during those nights in the cell, I had to champion things that once wasn't championed for me. And that is reading, taking a self-evaluation of myself, how I ended up where I am. And I began to decide that, you know, doing those things to others that went on in those communities, helping to ruin the lives of people's parents, helping to ruin experiences that kids will experience from the lives of parents who are parenting them, who may be hooked on those controlled substances. I said, that's not the person I want to become. That's not the person I want to be. And so, and if it were me or if it were my child, would I want that for them? And so I really took a self-evaluation of the lives that I was affecting while doing those things. And not only those lives, but my life. I was affecting myself as well in the community that I resided in. And so I had to really, really decide that this is not the path that I want to champion. And I decided that by all means necessary, whatever it takes, I'm going to do something different. And it wasn't easy because I had to really, really throw away 19 years of things that I had learned from the lifestyle I had lived and from the experiences that I had experienced growing up in the rural areas of Chicago and also in some areas of Racine. That lifestyle was the only lifestyle that I knew. And I had to say to myself, I want a new lifestyle. Mm.
You know, I'm listening to you, Carl. I mean, I'm hanging on every word. But out of the corner of my eyes, I'm watching Jim and Patricia listen to your story. I mean, it is so important for us to be hearing this. And Patricia Hansen, Racine DA, I think part of what you're saying is that, as Carl lays out, how difficult it is for someone to, in a sense, leave behind their old life and build a new life, that once upon a time, we took that for granted. We opened up the prison door, they walked out, and then it was somebody else. Was it really that unaddressed once upon a time?
Yeah, it was just a shift. You know, this is another agency's issue, another agency's problem. And I think part of the issue back then, and maybe Carl will understand this better than I do as well, is that, you know, in the 90s when we did have very powerful and very violent gangs in Racine, when you got out of prison, that gang was there waiting for you.
Mm.
They were ready for you to come back.
Maybe across the street,
yeah.
Even.
They were maybe even supportive to you in prison. And so when you got out, that was your family.
Right. And to leave that behind would be incredibly difficult.
And now that the stakes have changed in those terms, our gangs are very young and very unorganized right now. Now is the opportunity, I think, for us to say, we're going to do better when you get out.
Right.
You know, I've attended gyms through Racine Vocational Ministry. They do a welcome home meeting once a month, and anybody who's released from prison is invited to come.
Mm.
And unfortunately, my schedule being what it is, I haven't been there in a while. But when I used to go more regularly, I asked them, why are you inviting me? You know, why are you inviting me to this? What
well,
am I
right,
doing?
Because you're...
I'm the bad guy.
Yeah. I didn't want to say it, but I let you say it.
Yeah, and so, but what I found when I went to the meetings was words of encouragement like, hey, you're back and we're here for you and we don't want to see you in that same situation again, made a difference. Hmm. Made a difference. Letting them know that we're pulling for you, even if it's selfish, because I don't want you to come back to me and I don't have time to prosecute more cases, makes a difference. And
right.
So, you know, and saying things to them like, I mean, the struggles some of these folks have coming out of prison are things that people, the average person, doesn't even consider. Sometimes getting your driver's license back is almost insurmountable.
Mm.
And we take for granted that I just hop in the car and go when I want to go.
Right,
you know, so
right.
It's those kinds of things. Come to us. Ask for help. What do I need to do to get that license back?
Right.
And we can do that even through my office. Mm. Help with setting up payment plans, you know, how to contact the court, how to reach out to the right people. I certainly think, you know, I'm someone who had the benefit of, you know, a lot of education. I think I can give back in terms of soft skills. You know, sometimes, believe it or not, I don't understand it really, but people are a little intimidated when they meet me. That's a great opportunity for me to say, hey, let's shake hands, look me in the eye, and let's talk about how you would do a job interview. So there are things that I can do.
Hmm.
And with this change and these opportunities, and fortunately we've reached a point, you know, you can – and. You know, my job has its own political ramifications, but there's nobody I've talked to, whatever side of the aisle you sit on, who doesn't see the benefit to this.
Right.
Because conservative people say everybody should get a job, and liberal people want to help everybody get a job. So guess what? This is the best topic.
A lot of people.
Because everybody,
everybody's
on the same page.
Right. A lot of people come together on this.
And we
sure.
all benefit.
Absolutely.
We all benefit.
Jim, what did you want to say as Carl was finishing up his story?
I think one of the pieces that Carl didn't get to yet is it's when you come back and you realize there's support, there's this momentary euphoria that people are here to help me. Maybe it could be different. Mm-hmm. But then you have to face reality. Carl came to me and he said, nobody will hire me. I'm not even getting any calls. I got my resume all over the place. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm sitting at home. I don't feel valuable.
Hmm.
There's nothing for me to do other than to keep putting out applications that nobody will respond to. You need to help me. I don't know what to do next. And the loneliness aspect of that when Carl says, when I come back, I'm not going to hang with the old gang. Hmm. So what do? You sit home.
Who's your new gang going to be?
Your new gang looks like an old white guy. And that's not exactly what he was thinking about when he was in prison. And so, you know, you start to think rebuilding an entire life is not an easy thing to do. Patricia used the word, but and sometimes it's overused, but it's overwhelming. It seems insurmountable when you see, you know, your guys doing what they're doing and they're making money and they're buying shoes for their kids and, you know, getting them Air Jordans and jackets and you got nothing. And you keep saying, where's the benefit from me doing the right thing? It takes a long time. You got to push through to new ways of thinking. You got to push through to new relationships that take a while to build enough capital and that you can get something back from them. It takes patience. It takes a lot of encouragement. It takes a lot of willpower. And folks like Carl who come back and decide, as Carl said, he made the decision before he left prison, I am not coming back.
Right.
But then he had to face the day-to-day challenges of everybody saying no.
Right. We should probably underscore that was also a different time in which you didn't have employers desperate for employees.
That's right. That's right.
So you were probably trying to do this at a tough time. So how did you end up landing that job at CNH?
There's so many things I want to comment on that everyone has talked about. I can remember I got dressed up for a job. My previous pastor lent me his car. I had a driver's license to go to the interview in Milwaukee. And this is the first time I ever put on a suit. and so I had on a suit and tie. And I remember to this day, it was a brown suit. And I had on a tie. And I went to this, they had a big employee expo. Mm-hmm. And I was hoping to get this job. And when the guy came out and said, well, I'm afraid I'm not going to even be able to interview you because you're a convicted felon. And that crushed me. That crushed me all the way back home. I had got a driver's license. My friend had lent me his car to get to the interview. And then to say to me, I can't even interview you.
Right.
Not that you don't have the qualifications to receive the job, but because of your prior mistakes you made in your life, I cannot even interview you.
Right.
And like they commented on before, it's like, you know, I'm out. I have left the old people who I used to hang with. I don't have a new support system, so to speak, a large support system, I should say, that I can really go cry on their shoulder and say, hey, I'm doing the right things. Most of all, I've accepted Christ in my life, and is this the outcome?
Right.
You know, it's like, really? 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 And I just kept pushing. I kept pushing, even though I was let down at that time. I kept pushing. I had a few people in my corner who supported me, and that led to me landing a couple of jobs, and I held on to those jobs until I could get something better. I realized I had a family at that time, and the jobs that I had, I wasn't able to spend time with my family because I would leave one job, go to the next, and I couldn't be a father to my child. And so I came into Jim's office and said, this is not working for me. You know, I have a child that I'm raising, and I know what it's like not to have parents in the home, doing the homework with the child, coming to the functions that the child is having at the school. And I said to Jim, I have to do better. Is there any way that you can help me out to get a better paying job so that I can at least be of the same support system that was missing in my life that I know that this child needs and every child needs that is walking around on this green earth?
Hmm. So what did you do, Jim?
One brick at a time,
right.
Begin to help a person understand how to present themselves stronger and stronger. One of them is the job that Carl did, which could barely support his family. He took smaller jobs with lesser pay to create a building block where his resume, year by year, his resume looked stronger and stronger, and eventually was able to catch the attention of a major employer in town where, for the first time, Carl had a living wage job, health insurance, and the ability to work an 8 or 10 or 12-hour shift and go home and be with his kids, not to have to work two full-time jobs, just to not quite make ends meet. It takes a tremendous tenacity, and really there's a support in that as you begin to help a person understand what their steps are moving forward. We don't really give people jobs, but we're coaching them through and encouraging them, helping them to get their resume stronger and in order, helping their interview techniques to get better, helping them to encourage them to build the skills they need, both soft and hard, to get hard skills to get to the point to where that employer says, I want this person in my shop. Mm-hmm. And eventually, CNH was one of those companies that said, we'll take you in.
Correct.
Wow. Well, Carl, not only is this about you finally landing a decent job that allowed you to really have a decent life, a good life with your family and especially with your children, but you have stepped beyond your own situation to really try to make a difference in the lives of others, facing the very same sorts of challenges. And I'm also, I want to talk in a moment about also this wonderful thing called the Coding Initiative, which is especially an outreach to young people. But I want to talk first about the way in which you have tried to make a difference in the lives of adults out of prison and facing some of the same challenges that you have. What are some of the things that you have tried to do in order to be of help to them?
So not only out of prison, but I volunteer at RIOC, and I also volunteer at RCI. And we host an initiative called the MA Personal Development Service, where we go in and teach soft skills. We teach personal development skills that help those who are inside make the same decision that I made while on the inside.
So you don't wait till they're out. And that's probably really important. I mean, in many respects, it's probably way too late if you wait till that day that they're walking out of the prison yard. I mean, it's better to sow the seed earlier.
Exactly, because if you don't develop the habits of responsibility, of commitment, of a lifestyle that you desire to have while in there, 9 times out of 10, you won't mimic those behaviors once you get out. You begin to believe that there are not individuals out there who can and will give you another chance. There are people out here who will help you. However, sometimes if you return back to the same neighborhoods that you once resided in, that's not being championed. What's being championed is the lifestyle that you used to live. And so it is important that we talk to those who are incarcerated before they get out and let them know you may have to decide to go live somewhere else. You may have to decide to not listen to, in some cases, your parents, uncles, cousins. You may have to decide not to listen to your brothers and sisters or all those people. You may have to decide to walk as opposed to catching a ride with the old friends that you used to ride with. Those are the challenges that you may run into, but you have to be firm and say, you know what, I'll take the bus, and be okay with taking the bus.
Mm. And I suppose it's those kind of decisions that you make on Monday and Tuesday and Wednesday and Thursday. I mean, small choices that you are confronted with relentlessly, yeah, and making the right choices again and again and again and again. I mean, that's what strength is all about. I mean, that's what it means to be a strong person, able to do that.
One of the things the district attorney said, conservatives and liberals want those of us who don't have jobs to have jobs. That's what some of those guys in there don't understand, that they are desired to be employed, that they are somebody, and that they do have a special gift that they can give back to the communities that they once resided in, and that they do, in some cases, have families that are looking to really help them and are dependent on them to be the leaders of their families that they can be.
And, you know, I for I speak to lots of groups, and I've told people routinely, in 24 years of prosecuting people, I can count on one hand the people I think should never come back to society.
Mm. You know, who are beyond just redemption.
Just truly evil, dangerous people. The majority of who I see, I said if I could get rid of drugs and alcohol, I wouldn't have a job because there'd be hardly anything to do. Because people make such poor decisions when they're under the influence. But most people have just made a mistake or gotten into a criminal lifestyle that they didn't necessarily choose for themselves, but here they are. So everybody has redemption value, you know. And we, from just a fiscal standpoint, we spend a lot of money in our prison systems to get people ready to come out and be productive. And so for us to now out in the community not embrace that and support them once they walk out the door is sort of absurd if you think about
it.
Why are we doing the work we're doing inside if we're not going to do the support on the outside? So that's what this expo is all about, is bringing together those groups that are there when somebody walks out the door to help lift them up, whatever their needs are. And that's why we have a variety of service providers coming to the expo, because not everybody's needs are the same. And, you know, what Jim can do for one person might be not as good as what someone can do at a different agency. So we try to understand those differences and really just get employers now to buy into our mentality, what we know to be true, and be that person who really makes the difference. Be the guy who hired Carl McNeil at CNH.
Right.
And made that big difference for Carl. And now look what Carl's done to give back. I mean, it comes back to us in spades. I mean, you know.
I mean, especially in the case of Carl.
Most people that come out and find good jobs, living wage jobs, and support their families do find a way to give back. And we see it time and time again. So it really just benefits all of us.
Yeah. Jim Schatzman, what is the situation when it comes to employers understanding this and fostering the courage to what probably feels to them like taking a chance on somebody, including somebody who maybe with all the best intentions in the world, you know, wants to be different from the way they were. But, you know, we all know that how difficult we've been talking about how difficult that is. What kind of progress is being made on that specific question, would you say?
It's slow, and part of it is that employers, like a lot of other organizations, work on a risk management way of understanding how they engage their community. And so when you get 100 applications for a position, you go, okay, take away the people who have no driver's license. Let's screen out the people who don't have a high school education. And the HR guy comes back and says, I still have 50 applications. Can't interview 50 people for one job. And he says, well, you know, take out all the felons. Okay, and then they go out, and now I'm down to 25. Well, okay, pick from those 25 and give me the best folks that you can. And so really it's about convincing employers of the data. Some of the studies that are shown by the Society of Human Resource Management, that people who are coming out of prison are 1 to 1.5% by demographic more productive than people who have not been to prison.
Wow.
That's just not what you would expect. That debunks part of the mythology that employers bring, that this guy or gal is going to be a problem in my shop. What we're saying to employers is, with that kind of one piece of data behind you, are you willing to look past some of the mythologies and at least interview somebody? Get a chance to get them in front of you. And I can tell you, when you get someone like Carl in front of you, you go, oh, this is not what I thought I would hear or see when I thought about somebody returning from prison. I'm not afraid. You know, he doesn't have one eye in the middle of his forehead. He's not carrying an axe into the interview. You know, it's just these mythologies build up in your head. And part of that also is our job of the other side of that is helping people who come out of prison behave in more pro-social ways and use more pro-social language. Learn how to use a little corporate English in the interview so that you can communicate at the same level.
Right.
You know, and so if you can begin to help Employers right now are ripe for this kind of discussion because their need is very great right now.
Right. I was just going to say, I don't think a whole lot of HR folks nowadays have a pile of 100 applications for a job that they need to fill.
They don't.
Right.
Some jobs at the city, for example, the higher level jobs may stay open for 18 months
right.
while they're trying to find the right person.
Exactly. So I think it was Patricia Hansen who said earlier that the time is ripe for people to have mm-hmm. a breakthrough of understanding
mm-hmm.
on this,
yes.
and it's good to hear that at least slowly that's beginning mm-hmm. to happen. So we want to remind people of this reentry employer expo that's coming up on Thursday. Before we give that information one last time, Carl, I wish we had more time for this. I have about 2 minutes to have you tell the happy story of what you are doing in terms of working with young people and this extraordinary trip that you were able to take some of them on recently. So tell our listeners about this. This is so great.
So the Computer Science Initiative, the Coding Initiative, is designed to help educate those who are living in underrepresented communities, introducing them to computer science. Instead of being the main consumers of technology, actually digging, help them to discover the talents and gifts inside of them to become not only just consumers, but also creators of some of these things that we are consuming out here on the market. And so we actually... It's a long story to tell, and I only got 2 minutes. But we discovered that here in the U.S. of A., we are behind when it comes down to allowing the raw talent that is in some of these underrepresented communities to be discovered. And so we took it upon ourselves to really, really dig into how we could help maybe discover some of those talents or maybe open their minds to actually going down the path to be the talent that we desire here in the U.S. of A. It is my, and not just my thought, but I believe all of us who are sitting around this table, no one who is born into this world says to themselves that, you know, when I grow up, I want to be a killer. When I grow up, I want to be a murderer. Or when I grow up, I want to sell drugs for the rest of my life. And so it is that thing right there that gives me the fuel to go into these communities, to go into these facilities that hold inmates and say to them, listen, you have a chance to be some of the greatest people that society that has ever seen. To the kids, you are great. You can be the next one who discovers the cure for cancer or discovers the cure for AIDS or discovers the cure for diabetes. That could be you. Mm-hmm. You can be the one who can create the car that not only drives but flies or whatever the case may be.
Yeah.
You know, the sky is the limit in what we can bring to the table when we're given the proper opportunities to be exposed to the sky.
Right. So it sounds like you were able to, in this trip that you took these young people on to visit places like Google, that they could, in a sense, see a wider world of possibilities, and your job is to help them see that they can be part of that wider world of possibilities beyond the world they've known.
Yes, yes. Sometimes in these communities, these kids have never even been exposed to a plane in that way. And so for the very first time in some of their lives, they've been on a plane and they've seen what it takes to create some of these ideas. And they were able to have talks with some of the greatest minds in technology. And also some of their ideas may be the next idea or the next big thing that could affect our society in a positive way.
Mm. How exciting is that? Hope is a really important word, and it's a great thing to live out. Carl McNeil, you embody that in so many ways. Carl McNeil, preaches at Starlight Outreach Ministries. I imagine you are one heck of a preacher and doing so much good work in the community. Patricia Hansen, our hardworking, dedicated Racine District Attorney, and Jim Schatzman from Racine Kenosha Vocational Ministry, their Executive Director. Vocational Ministries is just one of the agencies represented at the Southeastern Wisconsin Reentry Employer Expo that's coming up this Thursday, September 19th. That's 8 a.m. until 1 p.m. Come when you can. And it's, again, not a job fair. This is for employers to learn about this exciting opportunity. Jim, if people want more information about the expo, how can they seek out more information?
One of our key contact points is Amy Greil at the University of Wisconsin Extension, and her phone number is 262-857-1900.